Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. What happens when people take to the streets to march under the banner of science? How do you sort out the truth from the misconceptions and lies? Is science in danger, and if so, from whom? And while we're at it, what is science, and does it belong to everyone? Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation came together to answer these questions in an event called March for Science or March for Scientism, Understanding the Real Threats to Science in America. The panel discussion included Director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute, Stephen Meyer, Director of Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, Wesley J. Smith, Jay Richards, editor at The Stream and a senior fellow at Discovery Institute, and Marla Lewis, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. On a handful of episodes, we bring you highlights of the event in bite-sized segments. Today, you'll hear all four panelists discuss what they see as the real threats to science in America.
Hi there. Well, thanks for all of your perspectives. It was already very interesting. And I wanted to ask, in a vibrant intellectual environment, there's never 100% consensus. You always have people challenging an idea and seeing how we can push it. But in a world where you do need to use scientific data to make policy choices, regardless of what they may be, at some point it might be helpful to have sort of enough of an idea of what's going on to be able to make a decision. And so my question is, how much certainty is enough to start moving forward with something? And I'm really not specifically referring to climate change here. I really mean any policy that might use scientific data. How much consensus is enough? How much certainty is enough? And how do we move forward on things that we have an idea might be the case while encouraging an active and vibrant community that allows for conflicting ideas and opinions?
That is a terrific question, and I don't think there's a clear answer to it, honestly, though I do think the reason I focus on this question of consensus and the kind of sociological factors is that I think the reality is that what those do is actually prevent society from coming to some kind of general agreement about how to apply science in public policy context, because obviously you're right. I mean, a vast majority of scientific questions, not even scientists know the answer to, and so we have to have some kind of social mechanism for saying, okay, look, we want science to be open to the evidence, and we want policy to be open to the solid evidence that science provides. And so that's why I actually, I think an honest and open debate about these things publicly, in which we don't invoke social pressure, in which we don't invoke ad hominems, is the best way forward on those things, precisely because I think many non-experts, you're right, there's always some crank that doubts any particular scientific claim, but they don't have social power, they don't have political power, precisely because they're cranks and maybe they have a private website. What's dangerous is that there would be a general public skepticism of science in general. That would be a catastrophic situation, and that's something certainly none of the panel want to have happen. And so my argument would be that you want a vibrant argument about all these things. And when that happens, I think the average reasonable person who's a non-expert is going to be much more willing to say, look, I'm not an expert, but I trust the scientists on this, than if they suspect at an intuitive level that there's a lot of social pressure being brought to bear on the question. And so I think there's a reason that the public is skeptical about some things and not other things.
I just quickly add to that the educated non-scientist is actually far more capable of understanding arguments pro and con around a number of scientific topics, provided there's some application of attention to those arguments. And so I think one of the key things that would help us both culturally and politically, as well as scientifically, is to encourage a true pluralism in which there's a culture of discourse, of rhetoric. The rhetorical function of science, I think, is being neglected. Scientists need to be allowed to have those arguments back and forth and to have that understood as part of the scientific method. That's how science advances. And as the scientists have those arguments back and forth in a more open setting, then people in politics and law who are also comfortable with evaluating arguments can evaluate the arguments of the scientists back and forth. One of the just in the climate change debate, there are a huge number of very prominent skeptics of anthropogenic global warming, their voices have been muffled. But when you have people like Richard Lindzen at MIT or Will Happer at Princeton or Freeman Dyson at Princeton or John Christie, that, who was mentioned before, these are high-powered scientists. They're making very compelling arguments, and their voices need to be heard, and the political people need to hear the arguments on both sides before they render judgment. And at the end of the day, there is a judgment involved, but you can't make appropriate judgments unless all sides of the argument have been openly aired out. So reinvigorating and encouraging a culture of discourse in science and in politics will help us make better judgments on those tricky questions.
And we already have some of those mechanisms in place, the regulatory mechanisms for approving drugs, for example. The NIH approval process in terms of funding for research and so forth. So those mechanisms already exist. What harms those mechanisms, I think, is precisely what Steve was talking about. I would have much more faith, for example, in some of what the global warming alarmists say if they weren't trying to stifle so hard people with whom they disagreed, if they weren't trying to prevent people with whom they disagreed from getting tenure, if they weren't trying to prevent people with whom they disagree from getting funding. I think the government should fund both sides of that debate, frankly, and have that kind of open discourse.
That's a really good suggestion, because big scientists can make a big error. If all the funding goes to one paradigm, then it's impossible to test the strength of the opposite one.
Exactly.
And we should have a lot more comparative hypothesis testing and funding of both sides of competing scientific discussions or debates.
May I jump in
here?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, Jay, I want to say you probably had this in your long list, but another tip-off that something is amiss here is when one group not only invokes consensus and tries to shame people and stifle debate through stigmatization, but when they call for prosecutions of heretical views, which is what has been done by Senator Whitehouse and Representative Liu and a group of academics that we like to call the RICO 20 for the RICO Act, and of course the Attorneys General for Clean Power, led by Mr. Schneiderman of New York. I mean, this is an attempt now to silence and chill speech through the threat of litigation and prosecution. So that's a big thing. But one thing, I mean, I appreciate this idea of the government funding Team B or red teams who would look at alternative hypotheses. And maybe that's the best that can be done. But ultimately, the ideal, as far as I'm concerned, would be to separate science from state as much as possible. I mean, why is it that we don't have these sorts of controversies in the religious realm? It's because religion is privately funded in the United States. Eisenhower, in his farewell speech, warned of this very problem that we're seeing. A lot of people just remember this as his warning about a military-industrial complex, but he also warned about the, quote, steadily increasing share of scientific research that is funded by or at the direction of the federal government. And he said that whereas historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery was the free university, there has been a revolution in the conduct of research, partly because of the huge costs involved. And it means that a government contract has become a virtual substitute for intellectual curiosity. That was already in 1960. And he warned the prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and gravely to be regarded. So he said that in addition to worrying about a military-industrial complex, which most of us don't really worry about that much anymore, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite, precisely because in the universities, the funding for the university now depends on getting government grants, all right? And those grants are given by agencies which are funded by congressmen who have agendas. And no government agency, once it gets on this gravy train, and no group of scientists who get on the gravy train, want the science to find out that the problem they're working on isn't really as serious and alarming as they said it was, because then the gravy train would stop. And then that's why if you're a university professor and you have doubts or skepticism, you better shut up because you might jeopardize our grant. And then it becomes self-perpetuating because the only people that you hire to work in your department are people who will toe the party line because your funding depends on it. Now, I'm not saying that scientists are falsifying reports because they are dependent on government grants. That's not my point here. My point here is that government basically corrupts everything that it embraces, which is why we have separated religion from government. And to the extent that it's possible, scientific research should similarly be separated from government. Then you would not find climate science in particular being a faction-ridden, orthodoxy-enforcing political movement, but rather the quest for knowledge.
I disagree with that. I don't think you can take, and you ever will take, government funding out of science. There's a lot of very basic exploratory science that is done that would not be done if it required for-profit companies, for example, to do the research, because they're looking to get a return. Some science research should not be dependent on obtaining a return. Secondly,
Of climate science, virtually, with very little exception, is all about impacts, and so much of it is not really useful, except for political purposes.
Climate science is just a small portion of what we're talking about. When you say to take government out of, you would never have this kind of discussion in a more liberal context. Conservatives tend to debate each other freely.
Yeah, this is a broadly Wesley. This is a sort of a broad disagreement on the right between the role to which the government ought to have science funding. Right. I do think it gets us away from the sort of core point. So thanks the Heritage Foundation for hosting this, and thank you all for coming.
You've just heard highlights of a panel event co-hosted by Discovery Institute and the Heritage Foundation discussing the real threats to science in America. For more on these topics, check out our written coverage of the March for Science at The Stream. You'll find it at stream.org/tag/ScienceWeek2017. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.